all our history of broiling wars.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free and independent ongoing conversation. 15 years in the making, from coast to coast, spanning the globe from the surface thoughts to the steamy core. Here, we welcome you to join our running dialogues and diatribes about politics, culture, global affairs, social media, anti-social media, music, and anything else that our shoulder demons and angels tell us to talk about. We welcome all input, both foreign and domestic. And if you'd like to join us, please contact me, Peter Elbro, on Twitter, at Bloated Nemesis, or my always and forever co-host, Charles Minnick, at green_weird, which is W-Y-R-D. This week, we have our first guest, executive producer Sam, bringing experience and education to a discussion of new media cash flow problems. We also have Weak Thoughts, a discussion about the problematic staffing of the State Department, or lack thereof, global updates, and a review of Static Selecta's new album, 8, in our hip-hop test drive. We'll start the show, as always, with Weak Thoughts. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. And a note. This episode was recorded the day of the Alabama senatorial special election. There may have been some incorrect predictions. If anyone feels the need, please send all edible crow products to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, NW, Washington, D.C., zip code 20500. There'll be someone there who needs to eat it way more than we do.
All right, Charles, how you doing?
It's a beautiful sunny morning here and in Alabama.
Oh, awesome. All right, well, let's get some Weak Thoughts going. We were already talking about Alabama, and then we realized we weren't recording, so let's actually get some content.
All right. This week has been interesting. There have been some continued protests in regards to Trump's Jerusalem decision. The only place I've heard any violence was Lebanon, where the riot police tried to quash the protests. But other than that, I haven't heard about any violence or anything untowards happening at any of them.
Wasn't there some in Palestine, though? Or in Jerusalem, I mean?
Well, Gaza Strip specifically.
Okay.
And it's tough to tell in the West Bank specifically, because the Israeli police are constantly carrying out like nighttime raids to arrest children. Maybe they arrested slightly more children than they usually do.
I mean, it's good that there isn't more violence. I mean, you wonder if there are seedy elements plotting and scheming and planning.
Right. Well, I mean, the Palestinians are pretty well armed. Well, I shouldn't say that. They're not allowed to have weapons, but certainly in Gaza, they would have been reacting more vociferously if they were going to. There's probably some element of negotiations at play.
I wonder if this is a, not necessarily a sign of the move itself being a good move, but more just maybe the conflict has matured.
I think there's some real divide amongst the Arab world about how to respond. It's like a continuum between Saudi Arabia's, you know, polite regard for the Palestinian people, and people like, well, obviously the Malaysian Minister of Defense, who said his troops stand ready to participate in any way that they're, or serve in any way they're called upon to.
Yeah, that was a little weird.
Well, it's for domestic consumption, and Malaysia's like several thousand miles away. Yeah, I've also heard that there's like the negotiations, as I was talking about, there's carrots and sticks being applied to the Palestinians.
By whom?
I think last week reported the Saudi Arabians had offered like billions of dollars to basically build a state for the Palestinian people. And then there's other backroom sticks being applied to make sure that, to get them to just go along with the program.
So the idea behind that Saudi offer is, if Israel, you know, was like, yeah, let's do a two-state thing, there would be funding for infrastructure for the Palestinian state. I mean, Netanyahu seems to be, at the very least, talking, if not planning, with the Saudis, so.
Well, yeah, they've been talking, well, more and more openly in the last year or so, but secretly for a couple, at least since the Iraq War.
So have the Palestinians traditionally, they've wanted a second state, right?
Yeah, of course, within the 1967 boundaries.
And so has the contention with Israel been more where those boundaries should be, or just the existence of the second state?
Again, it's a continuum depending on who you talk to in Israel.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, you get the far left, of course, who say they shouldn't be occupying at all, which is, which would pull everything back to the 1967 boundaries. That is, you know, where Israel's boundaries were recognized before the 1967 war.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get people who favor, shall we say, that one state solution, which includes no Palestinians on Israeli land. And they control everything between the Mediterranean and the River Jordan.
Whoa. Oh, wait. That seems pretty extreme.
Yeah, that's way. That's even beyond what we have now.
That would be That would be kicking them all out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's pretty horrific.
I saw a video on somebody posted on Twitter yesterday. I think it was from Abby Martin for the Empire Files. Went around asking Israelis about what should happen to the Palestinians, and like, there were some pretty horrific opinions being expressed. A lot of it relying on, like, biblical justification, like, this is our land, and they should go. We don't want any Palestinians there. Kind of shit. Oops, sorry, pardon the French.
No, that's fine. I think we're an explicit podcast. I'll have to check into that. I've been meaning to. Has anyone ever offered or anyone brought to the table, why can't we be one democratic state where everyone gets along and minority rights are protected? Is that
one state solution that's been proposed? Like, you know, something similar to China where you have one system or one state, two systems, but that doesn't seem, that seems like apartheid light, like a legal apartheid that doesn't necessarily require physical separation barriers like it does now.
Why does it even have to be two systems?
Because Israel is explicitly a Jewish state. And if you included the Palestinians, Israel would not be a Jewish state.
Is the idea there like a self-preservation that, I don't know what the population numbers are now, but I assume at some point there weren't a ton of Jewish people there, you know, earlier on in their history.
And, right. I mean, they were relying on the Zionists who were already there and like the Jewish refugees.
And so they had to make it an explicitly Jewish state, because if it was just a totally open democracy, they might have been the minority and been...
And they would have necessarily recognized the Palestinians' right of return, which is another issue. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be really...
No, it's just a big mess there. I mean, the idealist in me just wants there to be everyone gets along and everyone can vote and there's a judicial system that protects minorities, and they'll have hiccups, but, you know, they'll work it out. And that's not happening. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, there's
at all.
Factors that are keeping that from happening.
Well, let's get back to Alabama. We were talking about the election. So we're recording now. The election's happening today. We should have two reactions. So one, if Doug Jones wins.
And the other one, if Doug Jones wins by a landslide?
I'm totally not going to edit it that
96%.
Yeah. Well, I think that's more likely to be Roy Moore winning with some sort of Saddam Hussein-like returns.
Mm-hmm. 101% of the population returned, a 96% return for Roy Moore.
Yeah.
People rose from the dead to make sure that they're Dixie's favored son went to the Senate.
So, can you tell me about the, there's a court ruling, there are a couple court rulings yesterday.
A bunch of voter activists took, the Secretary of State in Alabama, Merrill, to court to make sure that they could preserve the digital images of the ballots that are cast. Which is important, because that's what used for a recount.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty simple ruling. There was standing. Well, I mean, there was a public interest, so standing wasn't necessarily as important. It was very easy to facilitate because the Secretary of State had lines of communication to everyone that would have been affected by the ruling and could have issued it immediately. It was a very simple fix because apparently the digital imaging software or the voting machines that they use have like just a setting you can turn on to record the votes. And yeah, and so the judge issued a pretty, you know, a common sense stay in that regard. Like, yes, we go ahead and have everybody turn on the recorders. It's obviously in the public's interest. And then apparently there was another ex parte, which is a, say, a private meeting that happened between the Secretary of State and judging from who concurred, at least some, if not all, members of the Alabama State Supreme Court who overruled that, or yeah, overrode that stay. The individual digital images of the voter ballots will not be retained. The voter machines, of course, are the source of all vote counts and all recounts, because apparently in Alabama it's against the law to do a hand recount.
Okay. So, if it's an issue, if they're not recording these digital images, then there'd be really no point in even doing a recount.
Or even believing the returns to begin with.
Well, yeah, that's the next conclusion to draw. So did they like issue a reasoning for this ruling?
Yes. Well, they issued an order. Let me see if I can pull it up. Of course, Greg Palast is all over it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there'd be a public interest benefit to not doing, to not keeping those images. And moreover, the way this was all done, it doesn't seem to be acting in good faith for the public.
Right. It is ordered that they may have 7 days from which to file answers and briefs after they might have a hearing about it. It is
but after
further,
the fact?
Yeah. It is further ordered, here's the important part, that this emergency motion to stay is granted, which is to stay the previous writ that ordered the digital retention.
So this was not...
That's like one word. Like this whole order is like 2 pages, and I just read most of it.
So this is not directly ordered by the Supreme Court, but they met with the judge?
Stewart, CJ, Parker, Murdoch, Shaw, Main, Wise, Bryan, and Sellers concur. Yeah, no, all of them concurred. So they must have had some part of this. And then it's signed by the clerk of the Supreme Court of Alabama. I, Julia Jordan Weller, as clerk of the Supreme Court of Alabama, do hereby certify that the foregoing is a full, true, and correct copy of the instruments herewith set out as the same appearance appears of record in said court. This is obviously never intended to be read aloud.
Well, as we were talking about before recording, that the way I understand most alleged...
voter fraud.
Yeah, election rigging situations is that they can shift it, and this is somewhat speculation. There hasn't been some sort of giant criminal investigation of this stuff, as far as I know. But there have been statisticians and journalists who've looked at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, usually investigators are actually investigating the crime as it's being conducted.
And usually it's a close election that they can kind of manipulate. I mean, it just goes to show, though. I mean, get out the vote. Hopefully that happens in Alabama today, because that Roy Moore is a piece of work. This week they brought in a 12-year-old girl to interview him to somehow prove,
to prove that he won't hurt children in front of people?
That he can just, that when there's a camera there, he won't molest a girl. That's what that proved. At his rally last night, the last rally of the campaign, his wife made some sort of comment that the fake news will have you think that we don't like Jews. Well, I can tell you, one of our attorneys is a Jew.
Wait, what?
Yes. What's her name? Kayla. Kayla Moore, I believe is her name. It's like, yeah, I mean, it sounds like a sketch. Like, that sounds like a joke.
This wasn't an SNL sketch?
Yeah. you know, crowd would have been roaring with laughter. And then what was the other thing? There's some guy last night. This to me wasn't super egregious, but it just, the whole culture around this campaign is so toxic. There was some guy who apparently hasn't even really been around Roy Moore since Nam. But he came and spoke, and he told some anecdote about him, Roy Moore, and a third unnamed person were meeting at some private club. And it turns out it was an underage prostitution brothel. And Roy Moore was like, we shouldn't be here. And so him and the guy who spoke left, and they left the third guy there. And the next day he comes back to base, and he's, you know, he's smirking. And then the guy telling this last night was, you know, chuckling and smirking about the story.
What the fuck?
Again, they're going to these ridiculous lengths to show instances where Roy Moore doesn't molest a girl, which is, it's preposterous that means anything to anyone. I don't know if it does. I suppose we'll find out. But that somehow proves, oh, because in Nam he didn't have sex with underage Vietnamese girls, that means he's not a child molester.
Or he got the taste for it there.
Yeah, or if he's like, you know, he was worn out from the night before. I don't fucking know. But
doesn't really matter.
I mean, or he's racist and he doesn't fuck underage Vietnamese girls. I mean, there's...
Yeah, it's better not to even think about that. There's few good avenues, you know?
Yeah, it's just ridiculous that this guy would have been telling this story and it... Doesn't anyone like vet these people? Like, this notion during, like, the 2016 campaign, how people... Some people preferred Trump because he wasn't scripted, he wasn't polished, he seemed authentic. You know, sometimes when you see that taken to its logical conclusion, you kind of just want the robot candidate.
Yeah.
I think this would be an instance where, no, I'll take the inhuman robot election bot than these crazy wackos.
I'll take, like, a political operative who spent 5 minutes with this guy, giving, and then like 30 seconds thinking about what you were going to say instead of this shit.
And someone in the campaign being like, hey, what story are you going to tell?
No, you probably shouldn't tell that. Can you tell about
the non-brothel story? That's not a good one.
Do you have a Nam under fire story, perhaps? Where you did something heroic?
I don't know. Exactly.
It's just the best story they could come out with.
I think he did win some big medals there. If I don't have his Wikipedia page up, but I think he did. I mean, yeah, that would have been a great, like, that's any traditional candidate would have told that story.
Mm-hmm.
Even most non-traditional candidates would have told that story. Nope. They told the non-brothel story.
Oh, he went to West Point.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm sure we can find some pieces of shit that went to West Point though.
Nothing. I mean, a lot of our generals did. So
yeah, I mean,
take your pick.
Okay, let's step back for a second, try and give a little benefit of the doubt. What does that tell you if someone went to West Point? What is it? It's high academic standards? Is that the main?
No. They have a very, very, like, their approach to higher education was nothing like what you and I experienced at UW-Madison. They have, like, rigorous military discipline they go through, like, every day. Like, they're expected to read and memorize the, for instance, memorize the headlines of the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and I think the Post, so that in morning formation, when whoever is the platoon commander or whatever quizzes them on it, they can, you know, recite them verbatim. This is before they go on their morning exercise.
That's to show that they can
retain information.
Yeah, yep. Retain. Well, that's, I suppose, yeah, that's good for a soldier. Yeah, yeah, but it doesn't seem, yeah, not critical thinking.
No. And there's, of course, the admissions process, which requires, like, a nomination from an elected representative. He was nominated by a Democrat, then a Republican. Interesting.
To go to West Point?
Yeah.
Or more? Well, I mean, a Democrat back in the 60s or 70s isn't, in Alabama, isn't.
But yeah, I'm going to say that he's going to win the election today.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not getting any hopes up.
I mean, I thought it would be better if there was a high turnout, but thinking about it, that doesn't necessarily help.
If you could see a precinct map of where, like, if you had high turnout in the, I imagine the cities and the black belts,
yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That would be something. I don't know. We'll find. But didn't they get rid of? I don't know if this would have a huge effect on this immediate election, but it's something like areas of the black belt have way fewer places to get IDs.
Mm-hmm. They closed a bunch of them after the 2013 Voting Rights Act was repealed.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, it's just like what they did in Wisconsin. If you keep people of a certain type from voting, then they won't vote and you don't have to worry about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing about Wisconsin is, makes it a little less horrible, is that was also happening in rural white areas.
Right.
I think it was something like Sauk County had, like, before this last election, 2016, it had like one place that you could go on a Friday afternoon once a month or something. Just, I don't know the details, but it was something really terrible. And it, you know, not necessarily a Democratic stronghold. It just, I think, just shows a general apathy towards high voter turnout, which even if you're not, which I don't believe they're not targeting, but even if you weren't targeting certain demographics, probably would end up hurting more liberal voters.
Right.
If I had to guess.
I mean, it works for Republicans. They can just suppress vote in general and win.
One thing about Republicans, they always have an ID. They always have their papers. You wanted to quick tell us about what's going on.
The Unity and Reform Commission and the DNC.
Yeah.
They just had their last meeting over this past weekend and came about with their recommendations. The most interesting thing I saw was about 4.5 minutes of video from Namiki Kant's interview with TYT, who's also a member of the commission, just like snapping on everybody there. In her word, well, to paraphrase, she pointed out that they spent $1 billion losing the easiest political race that history has ever, or American history certainly, has ever seen. And apparently the hundreds of millions of dollars that they've been spending on consultants was all going to the same 5 people. So there's a handful of people making themselves absurdly wealthy off of pushing a political platform for corporations and, you know, the biggest donors that still give to the Democrats.
So that's how it has been done?
Yeah, that's how it's still being done, too.
Oh, still. And they didn't vote on anything to try and change that, or
well, they voted in a bunch of recommendations. They said there's going to be some transparency to the budget process, because currently I think only the CFO and the chairman of the DNC can even see the budget, for instance, to find out who those 5 contractors are.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. They also eliminated about 60% of the superdelegates and put a fig leaf on there that the remaining superdelegates, even though they're technically unbound, should vote in the as the people of the state did. So, you know, you don't get that thing like Wisconsin where all of our delegates should have gone to Bernie Sanders, but I'm pretty sure Wisconsin only gave net a couple of delegates to Sanders after all of our superdelegates went for Clinton.
I thought they were split.
Well, at any rate, if judging from...
I don't mean 50-50, I just mean... So, yeah. So okay, well, just to clarify. So this recommendation, was they're saying that a state should put all of their delegates
right
towards the winner?
I think so, or proportionally, I think. Is that
okay,
what
yeah. Yeah, I'm strongly in favor of the proportional. I think our electoral college should be like that, personally.
Hmm. Yeah, let's see. Tammy Baldwin voted for Clinton. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the Wikipedia list of
who, oh, really?
Who they voted
for.
It has
names?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
This is a list of, yeah, the superdelegates.
Are they all elected people, or?
No, most of them are. A lot of them are lobbyists. Let's see. Dave Bowen voted for Sanders. Christine Bremer Mugley. I've never heard of her. Michael Childers. Huh, I wonder if I know his brother. Wisconsin, right? Yeah, a lot of them voted for Clinton. Almost all of them. Like, I'm looking down this list, and people who voted for Clinton are yellow and Sanders is green. And it's just like, oh, yep, Ron Kind voted for Clinton. Martha Lanning. Martha Lowe.
Well,
Martha Love, yeah.
One thing I say about when people get too uppity about the superdelegates is that there was the same narrative in 2008 about Hillary, and then Obama went out and started crushing her in election after election, and suddenly right, all the superdelegates changed.
Yeah, because it was politically unpopular for them to do so, and arguably it was kind of politically unpopular for them to do so in the last election.
But it was less obvious this time.
Right.
And I don't know that it would have made a huge difference, but it's either
certainly
way...
would have made it closer.
There's no point in them doing something like that that is politically unpopular.
Right.
Like, I mean, the only situation I could see where you do something like that is if the Republicans would have had a system like this and they would have all voted against Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have a clearly unhinged, mentally unwell, corrupt candidate that is a demagogue and happens to win some primaries.
Populist juggernaut. Gets what, an extra $1 billion in coverage more than the other people?
To be a little fair to Trump, during those debates he earned it. He owned those debates. I mean, in a totally unintellectual way, but
yeah, he might as well have just been yelling blah blah blah. Shut up, blah 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 into the microphone over and over
again.
But
you know, I mean if it would have been hard for any journalist, at least during the primaries. I think the general is a different case. But during the primaries in 2016, it's hard to blame the journalists for covering him more than fucking Jeb Bush. And
well, people like George Stephanopoulos were letting him fucking call into his show every weekend. That was a little egregious.
Yeah, that's a good point. That type of stuff where...
Like, he didn't even...
All these interviews...
Yeah, he didn't even need to show up at the studio in makeup. Just call in from where in his bathrobe from wherever fucking resort he was staying in that weekend.
Yeah, the platform he was given. You know, and then for him to turn around and bash these news organizations. What an ungrateful son of a bitch.
Right, those people put you in power, man. Have some gratitude.
So I wonder, you know, that's an interesting looking forward. Say he's running again in 2020. Whether or not he's primaried either way, or at least just during the general. He's not going to be doing that type of media exposure.
Well, he's not going to get it.
Well, on one hand, too, though, as the president, I don't know how to put this, but I would think that... I can't say that. I was going to say that he's too busy, he has actual work to do, and the staff around him would not let him just be... But no, that's not how that would work.
Watches like 5 hours of TV a day at best.
And he would, even as president, be calling into all these places. He'd be tweeting nonstop. He would, yeah, no, yeah. But yes, but to your point, I would be shocked if the media made the same mistake again.
The one thing that, for instance, during the primaries and the general election in 2016 that they didn't do is that like, they would show when Trump used the media, you know, pen as his private whipping boy and turn the audience against them, but nobody ever followed a Trump supporter who walked out of one of his rallies to ask him what they thought or, you know, hey, buddy, why you didn't like what you heard in there? What didn't you like? Is this not what you expected?
Yeah, there are a lot of failings all around, and it's hard to pinpoint the exact motivation or if they all had the same motivation. But you don't get the impression anyone did it for a, except for Fox News and Breitbart, did it for a political, like, hey, we like this guy.
I mean, they like the money that he fucking provided.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's greed run amok. I mean, everyone says how partisan we are, but if you look at the 2016 election, some of the problems in it, it wasn't a partisan thing. So many people didn't like him. Mm-mm. People in power, at least. Media people.
Mm-hmm.
But he used them.
Yeah, I mean, well, Wes Moonves loved him.
He's been training as a media character. That's his strength. And that's how we won.
Yeah, it's his only strength. It's the only thing he's ever been good at.
And I don't know if it's even necessarily give him credit, but probably. But, or at least people around him, but to have such cynicism about the American electoral process, to see that that is a strength to winning, not understanding the Constitution, not a foreign policy background, not decades of public service, that was a strength.
Yeah. That some, quote, deep connection, unquote, to the voters.
Yeah, deep connection. The last thing I want to say about just... Since we're on the subject.
Oh, I'm sorry. We've got derailed. I was going to finish talking about the DNC.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well,
yeah, so
we're doing it.
Yeah, we're doing it. Instead of talking about substantive change, we're talking about Trump again.
Son of a bitch. All right, so it's like a worm we all have in our brains.
So Nomiki Kunst and James Zogby, amongst a bunch of other people who were on the Forum Commission, finally voted on these recommendations, and now they're going to the Rules and Bylaws Committee of the DNC, which is full of Hillary Clinton supporters. So I don't expect any of these reforms to actually happen. Hmm. So I don't know what that means for 2018, but we'll see how that plays out. But I guess I'm just a pessimist.
Well, okay. I should probably stop making assumptions, but I'm going to do another one. I assume Hillary Clinton's not going to be running for president again. So what is the goal of a former Hillary supporter? Is it just a general establishment loyalty, or is there an unknown heir to the throne?
I assume that's the Kamala Harris and Cory Booker ticket that's going to be run in 2020, at least on some level. They're both going to be in the primary.
Is it just a...
Well, there's a financial incentive. It's all about these damn consultants. The ones who are, like...
Okay, yeah.
Before, like, apparently during Obama's time, they were still getting paid, like, millions of dollars, like, every month. And that's what bankrupted the DNC to begin with, so that Hillary Clinton could use that joint financing agreement and the concurrent memorandum of understanding, which the media didn't really publicize, but to control the DNC because they were so broke and they needed any money. But yeah, it's all about these damn greedy consultants.
Yeah, I think they've pretty much proved their worth, huh?
Yeah, I mean, $1 billion to lose an election. Like, yeah, let's not go to Wisconsin and Michigan. Let's not show her supported by throngs of people yelling Hillary and, like, cheering on her policies. Let's not spend the entire month of August fundraising in one of the most important elections in our lifetime. Like, the 3 months before the election, you're going to take an entire month to do fundraising instead of doing public appearances. You do private fucking fundraising for rich people.
And you know what? So, you know, us being in Wisconsin, battleground state, was important for the final. Mm-hmm. You know what I heard the last... I don't even know if it was a full week, but it was, I think, the weekend before the election. All I heard were Trump ads around here.
Mm-hmm.
Starting about, I think it was Friday, Saturday, that weekend, right before the election, as soon as all of these fucking...
Dr. Comey's letter came out.
Yeah, all that bullshit. All I heard were Trump ads.
Probably
where they play little sound bites of him. Said some shit about Hillary and, you know, vote on Tuesday for Donald Trump. And so what good did all that money do her?
Yeah, right. I guess you spent it somewhere, probably on those same consultants. Thanks, Neera Tanden.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't hear a big, maybe in, you know, we'd have to ask someone from Ohio or one of the other battleground states, but they didn't spend it here. They did not spend it in this market. And maybe it was just a Madison thing. I don't know, but hey. If Trump was willing to go out on a limb and spend it in the Madison market, which right. obviously reaches beyond the city limits to swing and conservative voters. You know, hey, his campaign did it right on that account.
Well, and it's just this power signaling. Like, a lot of authoritarian propaganda relies on that, projecting an image of strength that just keeps your opponents from resisting. So, you know, you put that out in the Madison area, like, you hear nothing but Trump's propaganda, and all of a sudden you're a Democratic voter in, like, Black Earth or Juno or Baraboo, and you're like, well, it's obvious Trump's going to win, so why should I even bother voting?
Which I definitely heard some people like that.
Yep, it's effective.
Yeah.
What am I going to be using my profile for? What am I going to be sharing? What do I want out of Twitter? So you want to set some goals.
Are you just generally confused about Twitter? What's a tweet? Waste your life in a
struggle for power. It's a very fast-moving social media platform, so you can post more than once a day.
I'm going to demystify Twitter. I know most of you have heard about Twitter, use Twitter, have definitely heard about hashtags. So today I'm going to explain all of that. Follow your friends, you can follow celebrities, you can follow pastors, you can follow banks, you can follow organizations, you can follow...
All right, so I'm here with our executive producer, Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
We wanted to have a little talk about new media. I think what prompted this was Charles seeing that Cracked.com fired a bunch of its staff because their ad revenue was not high enough.
That is the case. It's really unfortunate because they had started moving more towards, I think, comedy-oriented political reporting. And I think in this day and age, there's a little bit of resistance to people who move in that direction, whether they are sort of for the administration or against it. There's definitely a backlash among advertisers, particularly for that sort of space of discourse.
Is it a ideologically driven backlash, or is it just not making enough money?
So I think part of it is ideological, just advertisers seeing that anybody talking about this in any capacity is automatically going to alienate another part of their target audience.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also just that the bottom has kind of fallen out from especially video content on YouTube. YouTube recently demonetized a lot of videos and changed the way people were making money on YouTube. And so that has really hit a lot of content producers really hard.
Particularly political ones, I believe.
Yes. And then you also have just the upset that has occurred for all kinds of media over, honestly, the last 20 years. We saw it in newspapers first because they were kind of the front runners before you could get any other kind of content on the internet, you could get your local newspaper. And they made a really big mistake at that point. They didn't charge for their content because traditionally the way news was funded, the way printed news was funded was your subscription paid for the cost of printing and distribution, and the content within the newspaper was paid for by advertising. And
okay.
When newspapers first landed on the internet, they were able to fund their operations with advertising because advertising revenue through just banner ads was still pretty high because there was a lot less competition. But obviously we've seen over the last couple of decades, competition in the online space has gone up dramatically, mostly because the barrier to entry is incredibly low. Anybody with $15 can get a domain, and $10 a month gets you hosting. And you can call yourself a online news magazine alongside the New York Times. Now, obviously, the quality of your reporting will probably not be equal to the New York Times, but you can certainly call yourself a newspaper or call yourself a an online publication.
And a lot of consumers don't have the discretion to differentiate.
Absolutely. I mean, it takes a lot of time to evaluate a publication for its quality, the quality of its reporting. And part of the problem is if you don't have someone else looking into what a publication is reporting, it's hard to really know if they are reporting true facts. So a person with a website can say just about anything. And yes, they might be subject to libel laws or slander laws. But if they're talking about a public figure, the barrier to actually being sued for those offenses is pretty high. And the average person isn't going to be able to call up the subject of maybe a lascivious tweet and verify whether or not that tweet is true.
Yeah, it puts a lot of onus on the consumer.
Yeah,
to do all this work.
I think we see that as a problem with our major news networks, and publications. The prevalence of the slur fake news, I think, speaks a lot to that. Everything is kind of being called fake news. We have the president calling the New York Times fake news, but then we also have what have been traditionally considered credible news organizations calling things like Breitbart fake news. And there's kind of an equivocation that's happening with that term. What exactly is fake, and how do we define what a fact is versus an opinion?
And it started with the, in retrospect, clearly fake, like Facebook meme type news bits where people would post this thing like, did you know, and it'd have some sort of crazy fact about, you know, whatever, like pedophilia and stuff like that. And then it kind of spiraled into, at this point everything is called fake news by someone, at least.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we're seeing is this stuff has been on the internet for decades, because even in the early 2000s we still had Snopes.com, which was sort of the place that you would go to verify if something you had read on the internet was real or not. Yeah. They did some of that really early internet fact checking because, like I said, anybody can say anything, and it can be really, really difficult to ascertain whether what you're hearing is just nonsense or is the truth, especially if it's something that is so early in its coverage that maybe it hasn't hit mainstream news yet. Sometimes stories tend to kind of bubble up, like they will be reported on at a local level, and then they might land on the internet and be traded around as a rumor and then be reported on by national media once they kind of hit that sort of mass effect.
Well, I see this on Twitter a lot.
Yeah.
The something gets broken, and within, you know, a news story is breaking, and within 20 minutes it's all over, and there's no way a legitimate journalistic entity can fact check something in that amount of time. And that doesn't mean that they're all wrong, of course, but you know, I follow a lot of journalists on Twitter personally, so I mean, I think the things I see probably aren't as fake news. But if you're not, you know, something can break amongst. I mean, that's the whole thing with the Russian bots, which is they can get thousands of accounts spreading something, making something trending before there's any accountability or it's noticed by anyone.
Absolutely. And there is an issue of attribution and also sourcing. So if one person says something, it might be true, it might be false. You need a little bit more information. If two people say something, okay, now that's corroboration, but you know, they maybe got together and said they wanted to say something. Usually if you get three people all saying something, that's when it starts to catch a little bit of credibility. Now, the issue is, are those three sources credible? And I think that is one of the things that we really run into in this news, environment that we're in right now, is things move so very quickly that there isn't enough time spent actually investigating the source of some of this information that we're receiving. And of course, you have to remember, journalists are just people, mm-hmm. and people can be lied to. They can be misled. Sometimes, you know, you want your journalists to be really hard-nosed and really dig in and find the facts before they report on things. But what we're seeing a lot today is that one news source will report something and another news source will report something. So a third source will say, well, I've got these two credible sources reporting this, so I'm going to go ahead and go because I see that as corroboration. So I'll be the third source for maybe a fourth news outlet. And you can see how mm-hmm. it kind of just balloons out of control. Two people maybe made the same mistake, and it causes the entire news landscape to report something incorrectly or just do a poor job of reporting the facts.
Yeah, I notice almost every, well, I don't partake in CNN and MSNBC and all of those every day because it gets a little much. But when I do, almost every time I turn it on, there'll be someone reporting that someone else reported something. And they will say something along the lines of NBC News has not independently corroborated this yet. Mm-hmm. And then they'll spend 10 minutes talking about it, though.
Yeah.
Because they can't not. If they waited until tomorrow, no one gives a shit anymore.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there's also just the issue of expense. It goes back to this monetization issue that we started talking about. Reporting costs money. I mean, it takes actual man hours. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking about even paying a reporter minimum wage, which most reporters are not well-paid people, you know, it could take 20 hours to write or report on a truly in-depth story. And a lot of times, news outlets have had to slash their staffing by so much that they just don't have the manpower to do the kind of reporting and fact checking that they need to do. And that not only are they not doing their own original reporting to the depth that they really should, there's a lot of temptation to take kind of that easy money, like the low hanging fruit stories, and report the crap out of those, so that, they can fill airtime. You know, if you have a 24 hour news channel, that's 24 hours of content you have to fill. And, you know, even if you reported on all of the big stories all around the world, you still probably would have some gaps in that, because there's just not that much happening that's relevant to everyone that's watching. So, you know, there might be mm-hmm. a robbery that happens in Chicago, but no one in Los Angeles cares about a robbery that happens in Chicago, even if it's something that would be reported on the Chicago news. So those yeah. national stories, you know, they're few and far between. And, you know, I think there's either they expand a story out way past what it should be because, you know, they hit the point where they don't have anything more to talk about, but they just keep kind of hammering on it because they want to fill time. Or they take stories that have not been properly reported from other places just to kind of fill content.
Yeah, and you see them, remember that Malaysian aircraft a few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, CNN was all over that for like weeks. And they weren't really adding new information most of that time. And I think sometimes they find their bread and butter and they just come at it with every single graphic that they can.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets people to at least tune in for a few segments, which is mostly what they expect. They don't really sit down and, you know, even for the reports that would merit it, they don't seem to go at these for multiple segments, at least on the TV news.
Yeah, yeah. It's usually very much just a regurgitation of what is already known. A lot of times there just isn't anything new to report, but because other networks or other outlets are still talking about it, they feel like they have to talk about it, or someone will change the station or buy a different newspaper or tune into a different website, and they will lose their audience, essentially.
On Twitter, I kind of bring them up a lot here, but there's this account I follow that there's this independent lawyer journalist who does these in-depth dissections of the kind of Trump-Russia story. And he's actually broken stories long in advance of major media outlets. And sometimes they even seemingly see his and then do their own investigation and then, mm-hmm. you know, report on it. And anyway, he did something about, I believe it was his Papadopoulos. Papadopoulos went to Greece and got into some meetings there, and long story. But anyway, he did this maybe a month or so ago, and Washington Post just reported on it. And someone asked him, like, why don't you try and work with the media outlets more? And there is a little bit of a bias against a dude on social media reporting it. Mm-hmm. But also, he made an interesting point. He said, when I reported on this, all of these posts got, I don't know the exact number, but thousands of retweets and quoted tweets and likes. And when the Washington Post reported it, he also retweeted it, and he noted how many retweets that their actual, at least on Twitter, I mean, obviously mm-hmm. they reach people who just go on the website, but how many likes and retweets that got. And it was like in the dozens. And so he kind of pointed out, he's like, I'd rather reach more people, and that seems to happen with me just doing this on here, rather than, you know, it doesn't seem as like he reaches it, or that he would reach as many people purely going through the Washington Post or whatever organization. And there seems to be a, I don't know, I'm not sure what conclusion to draw from that. I don't know if it's a distrust. I don't know if it's poor marketing on their part or what it is. But that struck me. And he pointed out a new media versus old media dichotomy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's probably a number of things at work there. Not only is it that he has an audience that is probably more interested and dedicated to the content that he's delivering. Like he's probably, I don't know who you're talking about, but probably
Seth Abramson. I don't know. If you get
on
Twitter,
yeah, I know the name.
Yeah.
I'll check it out. But he's probably reporting on a particular topic. And so he's cultivated an audience that is focused on that topic and discussing that topic. When it goes out from, did you say that it was the Washington Post?
I believe it was the Post. Yeah.
When it goes out from them, depending on how often they tweet, they might be tweeting a dozen times, two dozen times a day. I haven't checked out their Twitter accounts. So I don't know. But, the more volume you deliver, the lower the engagement will be on any one piece of content, unless it really grabs people. And so if they're kind of just broadcasting it to a very big audience, they're not going to get the kind of specific engagement. So that's one thing. But I think you are right. There is definitely an issue of trust in some of these big media companies, in part because of sort of this low-hanging fruit issue that we've discussed. It's not necessarily that they are reporting straight-up lies or you know, purposely misleading their audiences. It's just that they are not doing the kind of reporting that people are looking for. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, I think a lot of people don't feel like they are being served by these organizations. And I think people have really proven that they're not willing to pay for coverage at this point.
That was going to be my last question, which was, do you know of any novel approaches to this? Do you know of any newer outlets that are profitable, that are succeeding, that have a different way of doing this? Is there any kind of path going forward for successful investigative online journalism?
Oh, that's a really good question that I really wish yeah. I had the answer to.
I don't think you'd be sitting on here on our podcast if that was the case.
Yeah, I would be doing that thing.
Yeah.
It's tough because I think different types of outlets have tried different things and none of it is really taking hold the way the traditional, like, legacy models would, because the thing is you had a captive audience then. What we really have here is like a news media prisoner's dilemma. So basically, because we started giving all of this content away for free, people started expecting it for free. Now, in the old days before the internet, if you wanted to know what was going on in your community, you had to cough up a quarter, 50 cents, however much, to buy a newspaper. You had to exchange money for that newspaper. And then when you opened the newspaper, you couldn't ad block the ads. They were there, you know, and typically they were a lot of local companies mixed in with brick and mortar stores. And those people are very much willing to spend money on advertising, especially at that time in legacy media. When you turn on the television, back in the day before TiVo, you couldn't skip the ads. You had to watch them if you wanted to see what was going to happen in the next segment. So they had kind of these baked in revenue streams that people couldn't easily get around. Now with the internet, and because they started giving things away so early, people have gotten accustomed to that. And so when you are a website or a newspaper that is on a website, all of a sudden that traditional ad revenue that you had, people can just use ad block and just skip all of it. And there, up until recently, were tons of ways to get around paywalls. I know because I've done it, in some of my work as a journalist, kind of, going out and getting a bunch of different stories to republish and repackage, I would get around ad blockers and paywalls all the time. It's only been in maybe the last 6 months that they've gotten harder to get around. And I think that is meaningful. It took a lot of newspapers a long time to even get to the point of having a paywall.
I'm still aware of one way to get around a notable paywall that I encounter that I will not name because I feel bad about it right now.
Yeah. It's for me, it was, you know, part of my job. And so, you know, unless my employer was willing to pay for subscriptions to all these different newspapers, I wasn't going to, you know, I wasn't going to do it myself, even though realistically they probably should have, and I probably should have. Mm-hmm. I think that's an issue with a lot of people. We all feel like, well, maybe I should be paying for this. Maybe I should be clicking on the ads and supporting my local paper or even a national paper. But I'm not going to. Not this time. You know, maybe next time, I think, is what happens with a lot of people. And so you have that. And I think that we are going to start seeing it with television media as well, as more people move to cut the cord. I think TV has managed to hold on because they still have that baby boomer audience that is going to keep paying for cable, because they want to be able to watch cable news, watch their local TV news. But I don't have a cable subscription. I don't think you have a cable subscription.
Nope.
Do you?
Nope.
Yeah. I honestly don't know anybody our age who does have a cable subscription.
And to be honest, if there's something happening that I see on Twitter, some sort of big thing breaking, you can go on YouTube and find channels that are streaming CNN live. That I don't feel so bad about, so I'm just going to throw that one out there. I don't feel bad at all. And it's only when, because CNN's like the disaster network. You turn on CNN when there's something huge going on, terrorist attacks, something along those lines. You know, this gets me thinking that this is a public good issue, something that, and I don't know if that means a government solution that's obviously problematic when it comes to media. We're one of the few, I think most Western countries have, they don't necessarily have just one national news service, but they have a national news service,
mm-hmm.
even really democratic ones. I mean, BBC in Britain. And I don't know if that's the way to go here. Maybe some sort of public funding of news outlets. That seems troublesome too, though. I don't know.
Well, we do have NPR, in a way is funded. Like, so here in Wisconsin Public Radio does receive some funding from the state. It's a mixture of funding between donors and basically our government, our people.
Yeah.
Help to fund it. So we do have that a little bit, but of course it's seen as somewhat one-sided, or I think a lot of people are resistant to the idea of consuming that content because they feel like it's not reflective of their views.
Also, they don't do, from what I can tell, NPR doesn't do the kind of headline grabbing investigative journalism.
Yeah.
They have some good shows that deep dive into issues that are fascinating and wonderful. And obviously there's some PBS shows that do the same thing, but they aren't the ones breaking the new development in the Trump Russia story or something like that. Or in 2016, I don't know, you know, Hillary emails or shit like that. That's not really their bread and butter. And that's what a lot of people want. Although it's a little bit too much of a good thing at this point. There's 20 huge headlines every day.
Yeah, it's funny because I think Donald Trump's success in the primaries, in the Republican primaries, was due in large part to that headline chasing that we see in our news media right now. The news organizations that don't have a stable funding source are the ones that are going to be chasing those big headlines. They want that big headline because that's going to drive a lot of traffic to their website or to their cable channel. And so they're going to chase after that. And I think during the Republican primary, Donald Trump was making headlines way more than any of the other candidates. And so they essentially would let him on as much as he wanted to be on, as much as they could book him to appear on their TV shows, to be in interviews, he would do it. He had a very different relationship to the news media before he secured the Republican nomination. It really wasn't until that point that he developed this kind of very antagonistic talk towards most of the news media. He certainly, I think, had some negative attitudes towards reporters and towards the news media, but it wasn't as pronounced.
As blanketed. I mean, now it's whole organizations.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for this little insight. Love to have you back talking about new media anytime.
Yeah, absolutely. It was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks, Sam.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Why should average Americans care about diplomacy? How does it affect the lives of ordinary people?
Well, I mean, I think diplomacy, when it's done right, contributes in a very significant way to what matters most to Americans, to their prosperity and to their physical security. Jobs for Americans depend more than ever before in our history on exports, on trade, on investment overseas, on attracting foreign tourists to this country, which helps create jobs here. And so in that sense, the work that diplomats do in our embassies overseas, as well as in Washington, to help American companies create opportunities like that, leads directly to more jobs in this country and to higher economic growth. In terms of physical security, whether you're dealing with a threat posed by terrorists or the proliferation of nuclear weapons or other kind of weapons of mass destruction, or whether you're dealing with newer kinds of physical threats, whether it's infectious diseases or climate change, the work of diplomats is really important and far cheaper, in a sense, in terms of American taxpayer resources than when we're driven to use
the American Foreign Service Association.
As it is, it makes a lot
tracker
more sense
of current U.S.
to try
ambassadors.
To avoid and prevent situations
the U.S. has
where
an ambassador vacancy in
Argentina, than it does to have to resort
Australia,
to use of force, which really ought to be
Austria,
the last option. That
Belgium,
you know, American leaders are called upon
Belize,
to use. So I think in
Congo,
in both those senses, prosperity and security, the American Foreign Service has a really important role to play.
I've never
however
been
many changes there may
Cuba,
be
Egypt, the EU, Honduras, Hungary, Iceland, Ireland, Jamaica, Jordan, Mongolia, Qatar, Somalia, South Africa, South Korea.
Did you say Saudi Arabia?
Oh, did I miss that one? Yeah. Saudi Arabia, Tajikistan.
Oh, and Sweden.
Sweden, Tanzania, Trinidad and Tobago, Turkey. A number of UN and other multinational organizations.
Mm-hmm. Most of them.
That's not counting some that are still awaiting Senate confirmation a year after the presidency started.
But I feel like KT McFarland's case could be a whole podcast in and of itself.
Yeah, we might have to get into her later. She's wrapped up in some trouble.
Controversy, to say the least.
There's a number of political appointments, which, of course, every administration would have. There's, to me, it seems like there's a lot in...
Because, you know, the ambassador to the Czech Republic doesn't really have very many important political questions that they're handling.
Yeah, but...
Unless it's pressing, like the AG's wife.
There's some other ones that stuck out, like Estonia, Finland, you know, countries bordering Russia, which would be, you know...
Belarus, but we don't exchange ambassadors.
There are some career, I mean, there's obviously most of these have career diplomats.
Right.
But yeah, we wanted to start it off with a list of the vacancies, and that's also not counting the overall reduction in the Foreign Service that Tillerson, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, is leading, where they are cutting funds and cutting positions. There have been some op-eds written. There have been some investigative stories written by New York Times, NPR, and so on. This seems to be troubling a lot of people, which is why we wanted to talk about it. I don't know. Tell me what to think about this.
This is terrible for America on so many different levels. Like, for one, even... Okay, so... saying you agree with our whole Cold War narrative, like the United States has spent decades and billions of, if not trillions of dollars, creating international legitimacy around the world and helping to found a lot of these international organizations that we no longer send ambassadors to, like the United Nations or even specific components of it, like UNESCO, which we withdrew from. So yeah, now that we're apparently cutting all of that, like all of that international legitimacy, our diplomatic legacy is now just being, I guess, thrown into the trash can outside, maybe lit on fire to provide warmth for poor people.
Just to interrupt for a second, to put it in a little more specific historical context, this is what a lot of people would call the modern world order was built by the United States after... mostly World War II, but it was churning a little bit before that. Mm-hmm. And it's to obviously promote peace, but also it's to promote U.S. power and strength.
Right. Let's not forget that Kissinger, in addition to being National Security Advisor, was Secretary of State, to give you an idea of how important they thought the position was.
This isn't just a touchy-feely, hippy-dippy concept. Traditionally, presidential administrations in the United States would also use it as a way to build U.S. power. I mean, this is it's not just about peace, although it can be, and hopefully, you know, is and should be, but there can be a sort of ulterior motive here, which that doesn't seem to interest this administration either.
Right. And well, I guess I'll lean into that through this part, but the way these missions are constructed is that this is supposed to be like all of the relations that the United States has with this country. Like, if you want to apply for a visa, you go to the consulate. If the military organizations of that country want to get training, they would go to the consulate or the embassy and talk to the defense attaché. Or, for instance, law enforcement, if they had a question for the federal government, for the FBI, they would go to the embassy and talk to the FBI attaché. And so cutting this, like, cuts off a lot of, shall we say, communication avenues and, like, the real meat and gristle and connective tissue that serves to form, like, public relations as, you know, the body of public relations and foreign relations with other countries.
Well, and also so, probably bog down the people working there. Because all these people are still going to go there to do these things, but there's more work for fewer people.
Mm-hmm. If, you know, those things are even done, so, you know, as you pointed out, like, you have somebody with 40 hours a week, what are they going to spend their time on? And even from a domestic political standpoint, like, a lot of these important decisions are always made by panels. So if there aren't as many people from the State Department showing up to be like, hey, man, maybe we shouldn't, like, go with the military option first. If there's no one to advocate for that, then, you know, you won't get those options.
This is probably an impossible question to ask or answer, I mean. But why? What's the goal here?
On one level, it's starve the beast. The Republicans notionally have always hated the State Department. Although, again, Kissinger was Secretary of State, but whatever. Leaving that aside. You know, it's part of the federal bureaucracy that is controlled almost by law and by the sheer inertia of the civil service. Like, you have a lot of the people in the State Department have been there for decades. I mean, I briefly considered joining the State Department based on my degree in international studies with an emphasis on global security. Then that would have been natural. Take the Foreign Service exam, like at least half the people that I was in school with, but, you know, for moral reasons, I chose not to. But I guess it's all the better because I probably would have lost my job.
You wouldn't have anything to do right now except a podcast.
Funny how we end up in the same place anyway.
So, yeah, I mean, this seems to be giving power to the military. I mean, in the upper echelons, it's been speculated that Mattis, Secretary of Defense Mattis, is kind of acting as the de facto Secretary of State. And whether or not that's true, it does seem to be that this would give more decision-making ability to military operations around the world.
Right, and the Pentagon. They don't have enough already, because they're the only part of our federal government that apparently is going to be fully funded in ways that we've seen before. But another point that I'd like to point out is that on that list of vacancies, there's one very prominent one, Saudi Arabia, which is having some very pertinent political effects. I mean, I can understand why that's a political appointment, because, you know,
of course,
there's a lot of politics in that relationship, but is Jared Kushner our default ambassador to Saudi Arabia right now?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, obviously, we have a lot of diplomatic relations going on with Saudi Arabia right now. That was, I believe, the first place the president went overseas.
Yep.
And
then he went to Israel.
See, but what is this? See, this is where I'm coming a little bit to a stumbling block, though. Why not have, are they not having an ambassador there because they just think they don't need one? Why wouldn't you just give the job to some flunky that uses to Saudi Arabia?
Oh, I mean, because you wanted to control the flow of information there. But again, that would be appoint your flunky. That doesn't make any sense to just not have anybody there. Like, at least give Kushner somebody to call to and relay messages back and forth between him and the Crown Prince.
I mean, is it, I think we've discussed this in a previous podcast, which is it just that they literally can't find people to take these jobs?
I mean,
because no one wants to work for them? Because it just seems ridiculous that they can't find someone who would do their bidding. That they
right?
can just
I mean,
put
even
there.
If it's purely for political interests, even if it's just a pure career polisher.
I mean, there must be a career diplomat at least running the office there.
Yeah, the deputy of the mission, or, you know, the other people in the bureaucracy would normally be just be keeping the lights on, right? Certainly
yes.
It isn't up to the Marines guarding the place.
Yeah, well, so, yeah, it just seems like you would want your guy in there as opposed to that person. Who
right.
may not be the official ambassador by title, but is kind of acting, again,
by
at least, at least in terms of the kind of bureaucratic side of it. It's confounding. I do have a theory.
Oh?
Yeah.
Tell me what you think.
Okay. So we know that Trump is petty and full of revenge fantasies. That's actually fairly well documented, you know, with Obama criticizing him at that correspondence dinner, and then that, you know, that launching this whole, you know, he's just obsessed with undoing Obama's legacy. I have a little bit of a theory that it's because Hillary was Secretary of State.
Huh.
And that... I'm sure there's other people, like, say, a Bannon or Kushner, I don't know, whoever there, maybe even Mattis, I don't know, that have some sort of cynical political reason for these things. But I have a feeling that to Trump and to some of those close to him, this is just a personal, I just want to undo this department that Hillary obviously would have had a lot of connection to for, you know, a few years there. And it's not like, you know, Trump loved John Kerry or anything either. I think they're just tearing it apart out of
pure spite.
Yeah. Just petty spite. My other theory would be, it's ordered, but again, speculative, tell me what to think type theory, is that this is, some sort of quid pro quo with Russia. Because obviously our diplomatic efforts, just by nature of them, more so than even the goal of each administration, would be to project the peace and prosperity of the West, which Russia would not probably want. The thing is, it's hard for me to find obvious... It's not like they have... It's not like Tillerson is writing... you know, op-eds in the Times or giving speeches on this stuff. He just keeps
talking. Kind of pointedly not, unlike previous secretaries
yes.
of state who have used their kind of mini bully pulpit for foreign policy in America.
Yeah, he's mum on the subject. The administration is. I mean, they've talked a little bit about cost cutting when it comes to, you know, just the overall reduction in staff.
But it's like 20 to 30%,
I think
if I recall
it's 30%.
Correctly. Yeah, that they wanted to cut from their budget. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, and there may be some, but the not even putting ambassadors in there, there's something else going on here, and I don't know that it's even that high-minded. I don't really give them that much credit at this point.
It's either stupid in that they just haven't gotten around to it, or
one
they
way or
don't
another.
Have any friends.
Yeah, yes.
There's no good reason to defund the State Department.
Unless
you
think you can't
America.
Control. So, okay. So back to what their goals might be, and then how this might fit in. If you think you can't control it, even with your appointed Secretary of State and appointed ambassadors, if you think that the bureaucracy itself is uncontrollable by the administration,
then you kill every third person out of 10 to prove a point, I guess.
Yeah.
Or remove them from their job.
It still confounds me. And what do they want? Like, so let's say, so what are some foreign policy goals that we do know about the Trump administration? Fighting terrorism would be one.
I mean, that's been the goal of every administration, basically, well, since ever, so, sure.
But would this, how does this help fight terrorism?
I mean, not having ambassadors doesn't seem to help.
Like, not having one to say, so Jordan and Saudi Arabia were on the list.
Even not to have, like, an ambassador to, like, go on their, whatever propaganda media that you'd want to use in Saudi Arabia to go on there and be like, hey, please don't kill America. I mean, I don't know how you guys feel about us, but we kind of enjoy our relationship. We have very vocal disagreements, but please don't go kill Americans. That seems useful.
I would think. And, you know, doing some other humanitarian... So take, like, a troubled area, like, that could be an area, a petri dish for terrorism, like, say, Somalia.
Or Tajikistan, yeah, yeah. Somalia especially, though.
So you have someone there who's doing... Yeah, maybe it's a drop in the bucket, maybe it won't work. But someone there who's doing some humanitarian work to make people more predisposed to giving America and the West the benefit of the doubt.
Right, and, like, the American flags that they see are on, like, bags of flour rather than, like, bomb shrapnel.
And to not... I can't even imagine that these generals are so ignorant to this, though.
Well, no, because Mattis himself, or maybe it was Kelly, but one of them said in 2014 that our support for Israel was putting a target on people's backs. Like, all of their soldiers.
And I think there's room to be a hawk, to be a pretty right-wing hawk, and still leave room for diplomacy and humanitarian causes. I don't think those have to be mutually exclusive.
So inexpensive, like, compared to defense.
Yeah.
Even from a fiscal asshole perspective, like, digging a well is way more effective than bombing that farm into the dirt. Or that village, rather.
It's confounding. Foreign Policy magazine just had an article about a kind of up-and-coming diplomat, Elizabeth Shackelford, who just resigned. And she wrote, "I have a deep respect for the career foreign and civil service staff who, despite the stinging disrespect this administration has shown our profession, continue the struggle to keep our foreign policy on the positive trajectory necessary to avert global disaster in increasingly dangerous times."
And Somalia is especially a place because we have, like, what, at least two different active military operations going on against Al-Shabaab in the south and the regional ISIS variants in the northern parts.
She wrote, "The State Department's role in internal government debates also had diminished."
That's the advocacy that I was talking about, like, yeah, getting the peace option or the diplomatic option.
"The cost of this is visible every day," as you were saying, "every day in Mission Somalia, my current post, where states' diplomatic influence on the country and within our own interagency is waning. To stem the bleeding by showing leadership and a commitment to our people, our mission, and our mandate as the foreign policy..." Oh, sorry. She called on Tillerson to stem the bleeding by showing leadership and a commitment to our people, our mission, and our mandate as the foreign policy arm of the United States. "If you are unable to do so effectively within this administration, I would humbly recommend you follow me out the door."
Woohoo!
Good for her.
Got dark over here with all that shit.
Good for her, bad for the rest of us.
I'm sure she's going on to a very lucrative post at some corporation.
And that just, you know, but...
Or rather have NGO. Probably.
We'd rather have them working in the State Department. I mean, this is, you know, this idea of cost-cutting... And so, yeah, in Tillerson's, I don't know if this is a spokesman, but they say how they want State Department to be employee driven and prioritize the staff's well-being. Yeah, I just fail to see how that's how cutting
is that things. Signaling he's going to spend more on security than people working the embassy?
Oh, that could be, but it doesn't signal that he's paying them more.
Well, it just signals that he's going to cut which part he's going to cut, I guess. You know, security contractors, that's money that they can give to corporations, but spending money on bureaucrats is just spending money on bureaucrats. That's not a pass-through to anybody but bureaucrats, people that you don't necessarily like to begin with. I'm sorry, that's just a slight bit of crazy conspiracy thinking.
This is the proper platform. Hashtag wild speculation.
But I guess we're already trying to ferret out the causes, but...
Well, and hey, the only reason there's room for us to be doing this, I mean, people in power obviously don't always tell the truth. There can be ulterior motives. Obviously, that happens. But when they're not even giving us real reasons for these things, when they're not giving us even bullshit, like there's barely any comment, and the comments that are don't even really address the issues.
Yeah, we're just filling empty space.
Yeah, I can't blame us for wild speculation in this case. I mean, this guy is Rex and the Trump administration are really falling apart or are really failing on this one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm gonna hold fast to my this is all an anti-Hillary thing. Because obviously she was campaigning on her foreign policy, her service, foreign policy expertise. And
get into that in this episode.
And well, yeah, but regardless, that's what she campaigned on. Mm-hmm. And Trump's like, screw that, we're going to bomb the shit out of them and fuck foreign policy.
Fuck their families.
Yeah. Who needs that? I don't have an alternative. I'm just, who needs that?
Well, and the other part of it is that, like, how are you going to fucking sell weapons abroad if you don't have a salesperson in the ambassador seat? Because, you know, a lot of those defense fucking contracts have to go through the ambassador at some point. Like, even somebody going to the head of, the chief of state over there and being like, so, we happen to have some really nice air-to-surface missiles that we can sell you, and if you're super duper nice, we'll even sell you the targeting packages to go along with them, so you're not just dropping them using math.
Yeah, I don't know. This one, maybe we'll learn more in the months to come.
Yeah, I hope to follow this podcast up with, for instance, what Tillerson is doing, like this whole reorg that apparently he's focused on. I wonder what that's going to look like in the coming year. When he does spend 30% less on the State Department.
You know, and talk about long-term effects.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that they're minimizing recruitment. You know, it sounds like they're going to be firing staff.
Right? It's like a real good bookend to the Department of State. You got Thomas Jefferson at the beginning and Rex Tillerson at the end.
Yeah.
And you get some colorful characters in the way, like, as I mentioned, Henry Kissinger.
Hey, this is a bit off topic, but not really. I'm looking at this, unless I'm missing something, I'm looking at this list of ambassadors. How come this doesn't even list Iran?
We don't even have a mission there. Like, I'm pretty sure even in Belarus and Bolivia, where we don't exchange ambassadors, we at least have an embassy. Like Iran, they closed the embassy after all that business in 79 and never reopened it.
Okay, so there's just been nothing.
Like, I'm pretty sure, like, you'll also see that there's none for North Korea.
Oh,
yeah, we don't even have an embassy in North Korea.
That makes sense.
We have an American interests desk at the Swedish embassy, but.
Which has no ambassador there.
Yeah, hopefully we don't have any serious problems with Sweden. I mean, you don't think that would be apparent, but heck, we don't have an ambassador with South Korea.
As important as
that place is.
Yeah, I wanted to point that one out particularly for all of this talk about North Korea and legitimate concerns about war coming up. Not just the Twitter battle between the two leaders, but Nikki Haley saying, I think a week or two ago, that, well, we might not send a U.S. delegation to the Winter Games, the Winter Olympic Games. We'll see how it goes with North Korea. Implying that...
Wait, so you're going to punish South Korea for North Korea being belligerent?
I don't think she even meant punish South Korea. I think she meant... she doesn't know if there's going to be a war there. And if there is, we're not going to send a delegation of athletes to a war zone. I think that's what she meant.
Means war could break out within the next month or two.
Yeah, I didn't even take it to necessarily mean that she has any other knowledge on it. Although, obviously, if there was she might. Yeah. But I just took it more to mean, hey, everyone's talking about maybe having war with North Korea. And she was just saying, if there was war with North Korea, we wouldn't be sending athletes there. But so, I mean, it just goes to show that there is a legitimate concern. And for us to not even have an ambassador to this country that we might be fighting a war on their ground, on their land, it's preposterous.
Yeah. Talk about a breakdown in communication.
Like, I can only see, like, their foreign minister, you know, being like, well, who the hell am I supposed to talk to?
Yeah, right? What do we call about having a political decision on this matter?
It's like there's some secretary in our embassy there who's like dealing with big issues. I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Leave it to the receptionist.
Yes. Receptionist in chief.
So, how many calls have we gotten / what's our policy going to be towards imports of South Korean rice?
And what, you know, so what if war does break out there? And you don't have an ambassador? Like, you don't have a fully functioning embassy for the Americans that are there?
Yeah, the embassy is in Seoul, like right down the way from the Blue House that where the South Korean Prime Minister resides. So in the event of a war with North Korea, that would be one of the first targets to be struck with North Korean artillery. So that receptionist-in-chief would probably be looking for a bomb shelter.
I would assume the embassy has a good one.
Yeah, I assume me and all that. And that's besides all of these other vacancies, as we pointed out, like Saudi Arabia. And maybe they don't have an embassy, or they didn't exchange ambassadors with Qatar, just on the off chance that Saudi Arabia did invade.
Yeah, there's some big ones here. Definitely.
South Africa, too? I mean, South Africa is a leading diplomat across, you know, most of Africa, not even to mention South Africa, Southern Africa. So,
yeah.
They're also a member of the G8. So, yeah, there's just so many bad decisions here on this list. Even if you don't value foreign policy, there's certainly reasons to have an ambassador. Again, like what happens if you have a U.S. national get into some kind of legal trouble there? You have to have an ambassador to advocate for them.
Yeah, I suppose we'll find out there, you know, once there's
more detail
and more crises, I guess. I don't know.
That makes me a little sick to my stomach.
And on that note, we'll be back after a musical. That is the lesson. Life is all a dream. I used to read Hot Times magazine. Rolling trucks would send dog up in the limousine. Platinum plaques upon the wall. Every day, burn a sack, a static. You recall? Had the stash box, pop. It is time to go out to the car. Do you have the blunt?
Man, I already rolled it.
Alright, I got the rough draft demo on the CD. Oh shit, this car doesn't have a CD player! Either way, we're doing a hip-hop test drive. All right, today we have a new album from a New England-based, or he's now out of New York, but originally from the Boston area, Static Selecta. He's a producer, so we're going a little bit different this time. The album is called 8, the number 8.
What is it with people going out of Boston to go to New York to do hip-hop? Like, if only Boston supported their local MCs, Guru would be repping Boston forever instead of Brooklyn.
You'd think they'd have enough going on there, but I don't know. Everyone just seems to congregate.
in New York. I don't know.
So this is his eighth album. Hence the name there. He's produced for a lot of artists, and you can really see that on this album. He has an all-star list of rappers on here. Usually there's at least two on every verse. On every song. I think almost every song had two. Yeah, and then a couple had one, maybe a couple had three. I don't know. What was your overall impression?
Well, it's tough because it's typically, you know, you're trying to understand what an artist is conveying by the body of the album. Like with Sci High the Prince, that was an easy album to, analyze because it's like, okay, this is this guy, this is his opinion. Then there are some other tracks that he threw on there because, you know, hitting Kanye's checklist and tracks that have to be on all of his albums. But in this case, it's like, this is more like a show that one person was putting on. And I will say it was incredibly well mixed. Like I couldn't tell any differences between the tracks. They just kind of bled right into the other.
Yeah, and he's an experienced DJ. So you can see that here. This is a party album. Throw it on. It almost doesn't even stop. It just keeps going.
Mm-hmm. And all kind up of until the end.
All kind of sounds the same. It's very soul driven, but seemed to have a lot of soul and R&B samples, and yeah, had good hooks. It was upbeat. There wasn't like a slow love song at any point in there. It just keeps going. It's a party album for sure.
Mm-hmm. Some really great tracks though, like Shake 'Em Up with Everlast and Be Real was one of the
highlights. So okay, let's get into this for a second. Did you notice Be Real's verse on there?
Yeah, they're both like complete like reworkings of previous hip hop songs.
Yep, and so Be Real's was Biggie's first verse from Juicy, from the Ready to Die album. Yeah, and so it even has the same cadence, rhyme pattern, a lot of the same words, especially at the beginning of a line. But then he'd add in his own detail to make it, you know, more personal to Be Real. Everlast verse didn't seem as, it has the first line of 99 Problems by Jay-Z, but the rest of the verse didn't seem as much to me.
Right. I guess imitation is the highest form of flattery, right?
Yeah. But then that got me thinking. I noticed other Biggie Ready to Die references on the album.
Like there was didn't he jack a beat or at least a bar for one of the songs?
Well, the song with the locks on it, But You Don't Hear Me Though.
Oh, okay.
Is,
You Don't Hear Me Though.
Yeah, is.
I mean, that's another song that's a straight up Jack. What song is that?
That's
that a Granddaddy Kane.
Well, I was thinking it was a reference to "Ain't a Damn Thing Changed" by Big E, also on Ready to Die.
But You Don't Hear Me Though.
And then the song before that.
And a damn thing changed.
Or sorry. Yeah. Things Done Changed is the Biggie song. And the song before You Don't Hear Me Though is Ain't a Damn Thing Changed, But You Don't Hear Me Though, which is what Biggie says in the song Things Done Changed at the end of the verse going into the chorus in that song.
All right. Get Down. Like that's a James Brown reference.
Yeah. And.
Oh, Nobody Move, Nobody Get Hurt. That's another. Like reggae reference.
Okay. Yeah, it seems, you know, kind of once I started picking up on that, the whole thing sort of seemed as almost like a love letter to hip hop.
Mm.
It doesn't necessarily have like a point of view that it's not really saying much. The verses don't really intermingle with
not even the
a message
between them.
But it's like, I love hip hop. I'm putting together this just,
here's the best hip-hop artists, because you got Raekwon and the other track, Nobody Move. And of course, got Run the Jewels, which I think is like either the number one or two single on it, but
yeah,
Jewels on it.
That was probably my favorite song, but I love everything that they do.
A little biased.
I mean, even the end of that song, though, he was like cutting and scratching lines from other Run the Jewels songs.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, it's just like this love letter, this homage to hip hop as a broad thing. I mean, no, he has, it's just, there's tons of you. I can't even go over everyone. It's a huge list. There's New People, 2 Chainz, Joey Badass. There's legends like Raekwon and B-Real. There's people, Prodigy, who recently passed away this past year from Mobb Deep.
Mm-hmm.
He's on the second to last track. That Joyner Lucas, who just had the I'm Not Racist song that's been blowing up on YouTube. He's actually one of the few songs where he's the only rapper,
mm-hmm.
and it was an awesome song.
There's no song on here that I would criticize in any way.
Agreed. Yeah. Every song's good.
Some stand out.
Yeah. I think you're right though, is that it just kind of blends together in a good way.
Keep the party moving.
And were there any other tracks? I like The Locks, But You Don't Hear Me, though. I really like that one. The Raekwon song. I mean, Raekwon's awesome.
All right. And then, of course, Run the Jewels.
Mm-hmm. The last track was pretty cool. That was one of the few that it kind of changed up the beat halfway through.
Didn't you do that in Harley's Blues, the first one, too?
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. That was the only song that didn't really have rapping on it, right?
I think Static Select actually rapped himself a little bit on that.
Oh, his voice that was is the him. One. Okay. Mm-hmm. I liked the one with, I'm not totally familiar with him, and I feel like I should be, but the rapper Action Bronson, the song I'm Watching Myself, and he's like, I'm chunky and I'm funky. It just reminded me of like a Heavy D thing.
Wait, isn't that a Heavy D line?
It might be, it probably. I mean,
yeah.
If that isn't, I would be shocked. I just don't know the exact song, but it totally reminded me of like a late 90s, or I mean, late 80s, early 90s. Type hook. I mean, he even said, he's like, I'm chunky and I'm funky and you're just a flunky. Like, that's just like so old school. Even though his verse wasn't really that old school.
I was going to say that there's some a new school and old school difference in the album, but no, there really isn't. They just kind of intermingle freely.
Yeah, I think he blends it all together really well. Kind of by giving them all similar beats to rap over. I mean, because a lot of it's similar tempo, similar sound. There's horns. It's the drum sounds are not really that. They're not really like electric drum sounding.
Mm-hmm. It's all samples.
Yeah, yeah. And so it all just blended. And so you're having very different rappers, kind of go on these similar sounding songs, and it all blends together really well. You know, I mean, you have Be Real and Everlast on one song.
And with 2 Chainz and Wiz Khalifa on another
one. Yeah, exactly. And Joey Badass and G-Eazy, I think, was on there. And yeah, Joyner mm-hmm. Lucas, a lot of the youngins. Yeah, no, it was cool. It was a really fun album to listen to. I don't know that it's necessarily like a culturally relevant or important one. Like, I think the Sci-Hi one was kind of, you know, you should listen to it type. This is just, if you just want fun rap, something to put on at a party or in the background while exercising, something like that. I don't know. It's just great for that. Per Donald Trump, at Real Donald Trump today. Lightweight Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a total flunky for Chuck Schumer and someone who would come to my office, quote, begging, unquote, for campaign contributions not so long ago, in parentheses, and would do anything for them, close parentheses, is now in the ring fighting against Trump. Very disloyal to Bill and crooked, dash, in caps, used, exclamation point. The intonation of a question mark was added by me because I'm confused.
Oh, okay.
I don't understand what that means.
Maybe somebody wrote that tweet for him and he heard, or like somebody's subsequent note on the tweet also got added to the tweet.
No.
Like somebody like put up a list of tweets and was like, oh, we used this one. Like somebody was just typing it in and like added the dash used.
I mean, what is even the disloyal to Bill and Crooked? I mean, that means Hillary, but.
Well, I mean, Gillibrand took Hillary Clinton's seat, or, you know, this Senate position in the Senate that Hillary Clinton had before she was made Secretary of State. And so she's seen as kind of part of that whole Clinton machine, or that Clinton wing of the DNC.
What did she do that was disloyal?
I couldn't even begin to ask. I don't know what he's talking about. I mean,
as much as we normally don't.
Right. I don't really understand what he's talking about here. And, you know, let's not overlook the fact that he sexually harassed a sitting senator.
That's why I'm reading it. Yeah. And would do anything for them. Now, if you were to, I'm sure Sarah Huckabee Sanders will be asked about this and she'll say something like, you know, political favor type thing. But that's not what he's actually implying here. He's implying
hitting back at something she said, apparently.
I think she was one of these he should resign because of sexual harassment. And then he doubled down on sexual harassment.
This is just the way we talk to women.
Locker room talk on Twitter by the president.
If it's in public, it's not in the locker room. I mean, to be fair, the locker room talk is a strange expectation of privacy. I mean, maybe not strange, but there is an expectation of privacy. So when you're having a conversation, I can understand why it might be a little more unguarded, but I don't see how that's appropriate even then.
Yeah, and to not, well, I guess he did apologize technically for that, but it was a fake apology. You know, I'm sure I've said some, I don't know if I've ever said, I certainly have never said anything about grabbing women by the pussy. But if I've said anything off color, and then I was running for president, and then someone had recorded that and put it out there, I think I would feel bad.
Yeah, some personal shame, you know?
Yeah, and he doesn't. He doesn't.
The rest of the world doesn't really matter to him.
I mean, what is even the lightweight part of this? Does that mean she's not?
I don't know. It's just kind of belittling.
Yeah, just finding a way to
calling her a lightweight because she's the junior senator from New York against Chuck Schumer, who's been there for like 30 years or whatever.
Yeah, is that? Yeah, she's not as powerful as other senators.
Is that critiquing her figure or something? I don't know.
Is he saying that she's too thin or something?
She's not attractive. Yeah. Because that's normally how he attacks women, right?
Yeah. Talking about their, you know, like Mika Brzezinski talking about her bleeding from the face or something.
Yeah. From the you know what, I think he said.
I'm actually looking at pictures of her now. I wouldn't call her, like, too thin. She doesn't look anorexic or anything, but she's not. I can just picture that he would have called her fat if she was, like, a little bit overweight.
Or some other type of body shaming.
Yeah.
So here's an interesting response. Mark Noller, the CBS White House correspondent, tweeted a couple hours ago, headed for the door, President Trump waved off a question about his tweet saying Senator Gillibrand, quote, would do anything, unquote, for a campaign contribution. Jim Acosta said he had been told by Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders he might never be allowed again in a press pool event if he asked a question, but did so anyway. And there's a accompanying picture of the back of Trump's back with Kelly near the door and some generals standing awkwardly around at the end of the press event.
Wow.
Yeah. So way to go, Jim Acosta. If you lose your job, I hope you get a better one. I feel if a journalist gets fired for covering Trump too well, that's just like an automatic promotion. Like, well, you're now your deputy editor.
That Jim Acosta's been one of the more vocal. I think he's a big reason why, not the sole reason, but a big reason why Trump is all anti-CNN, yeah, calling him fake news. It's because Acosta's fairly
vocal.
Yeah, during the press conferences. I don't know. Can they get rid of a person but not an organization from the press pool?
I'll have to ask, but I don't think so. I mean, I think like the organization is credentialed, but maybe this press office could be like, well, we don't like this particular reporter that you sent, and maybe they'll send somebody else. But this seems like another one of those cases where the federal government shouldn't be interfering with the hiring and firing decisions of a private organization.
Yeah, which they're very comfortable doing.
Super comfort. Super yeah. comfortable. Like, I don't know if they've even heard the phrase Hatch Act other than, like, on those forms that they probably gloss over and sign.
It's more fake news to them.
What is this law? You keep saying the word law, but I ain't never seen no book.
I could only imagine. Who's their ethics lawyer in the White House? He just must be, like, aging very rapidly.
I think, if I recall, that guy was one of Trump's personal lawyers in the past.
Oh, of course. Okay. So he's used to that bullshit.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's the one that exited recently.
No, that's Walter Schaub. That guy, yeah. I mean, he's, like, carrying on the resistance on his back out from outside. Yeah, I can't imagine they're doing their job very as much as they would in the past. It looks like Walter Schaub is more active in oversight now that he's out of government than he would have been able to be inside.
Well, this, what is it, James Schultz announced resignation?
Wait, the guy that who was the acting director?
This is per Politico. After almost a year in the White House counsel's office tackling a raft of ethics and financial disclosure issues, James Schultz resigned last week and is returning to private practice at the Philadelphia-based law firm where he previously worked.
Huh. Rotating door, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to try to do that job in the Trump administration? Like we were talking about last week and even earlier this podcast where they, you know, the well's kind of dry. They don't have too many more resumes on the pile to throw into jobs. Who would you get to do your ethics work? You might as well appoint John Dowd.
Yeah.
Let's see, what's going to come up this week? I guess tonight we're going to find out that Roy Moore won the election in Alabama. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. That's the negative critical pessimist in me saying that after all the legal shenanigans.
Yeah, it's, regardless of shenanigans, it was possible to happen anyway, and shenanigans are only increasing that likelihood.
I guess that's a failsafe in case he looks like he might lose more than anything.
Yeah. Are there any, has there been any news about Myanmar or Saudi Arabia, some of our favorite talking points on the pod?
There was a New York Times piece, I don't know we were talking about this earlier, but I'm not sure if we recorded, about the Birkin 2 missile that Houthi Alliance apparently shot at the Riyadh International Airport.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about that?
Okay, so a few weeks ago, the Houthis shot off a Birkin 2, a type of Scud, or a Scud variant, towards the international airport in Saudi Arabia. At the time, it was reported that the Patriot missile batteries in Riyadh intercepted the missile, but according to reporting from the New York Times that came out today, some forensic analysis analysts and scientists looked at reconstructed events, and apparently the missile defenses didn't hit the missile at all. Like, this kind of Birkin 2 missile traveling, like, hundreds of kilometers, like, I think in this case it traveled approximately 610 kilometers over the course of its flight. Typically, when it reaches, like, you know, an intercontinental ballistic missile or longer-range missiles, the warhead, the part with the explosive, will come off the rest of the missile because it's harder to hit with a missile interceptor and defense system like, you know, your Patriots or the S-300s that the Russians use.
Yeah.
And so this Times article, like, looked at the forensic footage, you know, the pieces of the missiles the Saudi Arabians keep showing pictures of, but none of the pieces that they had on display included any part of the warhead. Like, they had a part that might be the guidance system, they had part of the engine, they had the body of the missile, and you could see, like, the top where the fuel was, or the top of the fuel compartment, but no warhead. And other media footage from the time, like at the airport, said that they had been shaken out of their seats by an explosion in the domestic terminal, and come to find out, you know, based on the witnesses and the videos and pictures that they pieced together, what appeared to be the warhead landed at the end of the runway about a kilometer away from the domestic terminal. And the warhead went completely over the Patriot missile batteries. They were successful beyond their wildest dreams, and the funny part is that the Saudi propaganda would keep them from even knowing how successful they were. I mean, I assume that they don't have people in Riyadh, but maybe they do.
Yeah, I would think news would eventually get back to them.
Mm-hmm.
At least now that, you know, us here in America are finding out. So, I mean, is this... I don't know, is it... Should I be expecting them to shoot more missiles that way now? If they have them.
Well, the New York Times article is going towards how unreliable missile defense is, which is true. But it does kind of embolden the Houthis.
Yeah.
That they can shoot missiles like this. But ever since then, the Saudi Arabian government has been putting out an especially harsh blockade, which apparently the UN convinced them to lighten slightly, but there's been no practical effect of aid reaching people on the ground yet that I've seen reported.
Yeah, so maybe they didn't have more missiles. So, or it's harder to get them now if there is any, you know, if Iran is even sending
them. Well, I mean, that's the thing. They would have taken months, or at least, like, at best, it would have taken a few days of people working around the clock to get that missile ready, to put it back together and put the pieces back together and refuel it and set it up. No, it's not a simple operation. And I know we mentioned this before, maybe not on the podcast, but if Iran provided this missile, it would have had to go through the embargo, you know, the complete air and space embargo that the Saudi-led coalition has imposed around Yemen. So it would have had to be smuggled in on a fishing boat or... But it would have been come in bits and pieces.
Maybe it's like the old Johnny Cash song, one piece at a time.
Yeah, except a missile, like the body of a missile is huge.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, the song had a ridiculous premise, too. yeah. Any other updates on past issues?
Nothing.
I don't think so. Yeah, I think we covered
like everything. Like, apparently all the Western journalists left Zimbabwe, so we won't hear about that until somebody's dead in the streets, probably, or there's an election.
They left because there's no longer breaking news.
Right. Yeah. Like, oh, well, I mean, of course there's local reporting, which I still rely on. The New Herald and Zimbabwe Daily that you can find on allafrica.com.
Probably some South African reporters there, I would think.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like Puerto Rico has a little bit more power than they did before, but parts of the island still don't have any power, and I think like half of people don't have water or sanitation.
That's remarkable. Still, so it's long later.
Second-class Americans, not even second-class citizens. Yeah,
I don't think the administration sees a political benefit to doing anything there. It's not like...
Yeah, it's not like you're going to make those voters more Republican, like in Texas and Florida.
Well, how does that work? They don't have electoral votes, right?
I guess technically they don't really vote, so maybe I guess we shouldn't really be surprised about this.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
There you go. I mean, I guess I hope the Thomas fire in Los Angeles is fully contained and put out.
Oh, yeah, the fire.
Like, all of California is burning, as it has been for the past half years, at least. And there's a lot of fires that are barely contained in the northern part. But, you know, it's not L.A. where you can more easily have TV cameras just turn and look at them rather than go to someplace deep in the woods and mountains.
I mean, some of those images from the past couple weeks are worse than Mordor. I mean, they are hell on earth. They mm-hmm. literally look like hell.
Yeah, but those weren't even as big as some of the wildfires that they were fighting in Montana earlier this year.
Yeah. Just massive swaths of land, completely engulfed in flame, visible from space. Whew, man. There's just people driving on the interstate versus
and trying to evacuate, if I had to bet. Although it was pretty endearing to see that one video of the guy got out of his car to rescue the rabbit.
I saw that. That was adorable. I wonder how he saw it from the...
Yeah, from the car.
You wouldn't think you would have
seen a rabbit moving amongst the... Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
That guy's a hero.
Yeah, he is. He refused to be identified, I think, by some journalist that saw it, or someone who saw it.
Even better.
Mm-hmm.
Benevolent man. He's a superhero out there somewhere.
Yeah. Rabbit man. Yeah. Do you have one last wild prediction for the week? Anything?
I'm still waiting for an announcement from Riyadh about this whole Trump decision. I mean, they've put out their milquetoast, like, we are greatly in opposition to this move. And, of course, they went to the Arab League summit. But I don't think the Arab League actually put out a statement in response to the Jerusalem thing, which is kind of telling that they couldn't come to that kind of consensus. So we'll see what they announce in the week ahead after they've had more time to cogitate.
I think there's going to be something domestically, politically. I don't know. Because when you combine the president getting wild on Twitter again, when you combine the whatever's going to go down in Alabama, when you factor in, you were talking about earlier, I think before a recording, about what the New York Times doing a report on a bunch of legislatures who might have been part of those congressmen.
The Times and the Post apparently are working on stories to out like 20 to 30 different people in Congress who made out settlements for sexual harassment.
Yeah, and then throw in the ever present specter of Robert Mueller.
Bannon's got it. I mean, I understand why Mueller hasn't interviewed Bannon, because Bannon would have no responsibility to keep it secret, and being head of a media company, he might as well just put a video. He'd probably just walk out of the interview room and look into a camera and just spit out verbatim what Mueller asked him.
That might actually be a reason to not interview him until...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He's got to go last.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah.
And Kellyanne.
Well, now Kellyanne presumably wouldn't...
Wait, are you Kate? Are you Kellyanne, or are we interviewing Kate McKinnon again? Damn it!
So something we're going to be talking about something big next week. I'm certain of it. There's going to be, I don't know, maybe someone really big's going to resign, or a massive amount of people resigning. President could do something really wild. I don't know what he keeps raising the bar for himself, so it's hard to say. I did see that some of the congressmen are pushing for investigation into the New York FBI, the so-called Trumplandia, or whatever they called it.
Oh, the office there?
Yeah, pushing kind of back against the Republicans critiquing the FBI. And so now they're pushing back on that office's handling of Anthony Weiner's computer and all that. The idea is that they delayed looking into it so as to make all these threats about releasing terrible emails, incriminating Hillary emails, but they never had those, which is why Comey eventually took it over, got the job done in a week, but they put it off for weeks and they just kept threatening to release something terrible.
Right, and after Seth Abramson's super long thread about True Pundit,
the True Pundit had
FBI sources, probably from within that office, that were feeding Trump and feeding a bunch of punditry.
So hopefully these Democrats start fighting a little bit here. We'll see.
Hopefully. But to my mind, that starts with, like, reforming the party and getting them off the seat of corporations. Like, Bernie Sanders is 27 at a time model really, really broke their business model. It's like, if you get everybody to care about what you fight for, you are successful? Oh.
I don't really know if that's going to happen.
like the Rules and Bylaws Committee literally have no Bernie supporters on it, so I'm going to bet that it's going to be a pro forma, like, 5-4 vote and against it, and they're going to come out with some milquetoast advice for superdelegates in the future, like, hey, maybe don't be so egregiously against the people's wishes.
Yeah. Hey, when are they nominated, or when is Minnesota picking their next senator?
It's gotta be soon,
I would think. Yeah.
I so imagine it's probably going to be after Christmas week.
But is Franken, does he have the seat? Does he vote until?
No, I think he resigned immediately, right? He's already back home in Minnesota.
So there's four, or there's 99 senators.
98.
Well, no, the guy from Alabama's still.
Oh, is he? Strange.
Yeah, I think he's he would, if there was something today, he would vote on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I suppose he's still holding the seat for the moment.
Alright, so, I got 99 senators, but,
a progressive anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I guess progressive.
Yeah, we got it, Bernie. Alright, well, it's been fun. See you next week.
Days of sunny, days of rain. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains!